Six. Music. Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Bernard Butler.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Kicking off this new series, we have a musician, songwriter and producer who first came to people's attention playing guitar in Suede, a role that earned him no small amount of acclaim and placed him in the pantheon of those great, distinctive British guitar players, following a lineage you can draw from Pete Townsend to Mick Ronson and from Johnny Marr to Graham Coxon. But Suede's success was just the jumping-off point for a career that saw him collaborate with artists including Edwyn Collins, The Libertines, Pet Shop Boys, Duffy and recently Jesse Buckley for the brilliant album The Eagle and the Dove. He's become an amazing producer and helmed some great albums himself too. We opened with You from the first of his two albums with David McAlmont, and early this year he released Good Grief, his first solo album in 25 years. I'm pleased to welcome to The First Time Bernard Butler. In the show, we talk about Bernard's earliest musical influences, the Velvet Underground, New Order and the Smiths, as well as his time in Suede. We also discuss many of those brilliant collaborations, including the stone-cold classic Yes by McAlmont and Butler. And we get a fascinating insight into how Bernard approaches production and songwriting. But I started by asking Bernard, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
I played recorder, as everyone does. And I was asked to be part of the Christmas concert playing When a Child is Born by Johnny Mathis as the recorder player. And so I brought and musical instrument home. We didn't have musical instruments in my house at all, and no one played any. So I was the first person to bring something home and start learning it. And I was the youngest child, so you felt like, oh, I can do something maybe. You know, my older brothers could sort of hit me or something, you know, or kick a football much further than me, but I could do this. And also, the mums loved it, you know? You know, the Christmas concert when you're the little boy with the recorder, the mums just suddenly were just like in tears and you're just like, yeah, this is good.
The massed sound of kids playing the recorder together is one of the most damaging, like, so awful noises.
I know, it's horrible, yeah. So I don't know if it was the first time I'd heard music, but it's definitely the first time I was aware of being able to make it, which is sort of the same thing for me.
Yeah.
And I think from that point onwards, being able to hear it and create it has been quite hard to separate.
Yeah. But having older brothers, then, like, traditionally, if you have older siblings, then their music, because obviously, you know, there's some sort of like, oh, whatever they're doing carries a certain cachet because they're older. Was that in
both my older brothers fed me music, and that's where I got everything from. And particularly my oldest brother Stephen, I shared a room with him in my teenage years. So when I was 13, 14, he was 4 years above me, so he was like 17 and 18, so basically a big man for me. But he brought all the music home, so everything he brought home in those 3 or 4 years just changed everything for me, and I still carry that. Was my 10,000 hours.
Can you remember any specific records that you would have moved through?
At that time, in teenage years?
Yeah.
We were very lucky because at that time, we didn't listen to old music. Like, everything now is about old music and listening to things from the past and having an awareness of vintage music, vintage clothes, vintage everything. And this is 1983, and we weren't into that. We were into whatever was happening right then. And I wasn't really aware of the importance of the music I was listening to, but it was just what was coming out every week. So every week there was a new song by The Smiths and something by the Cocteau Twins, Aztec Camera, and you could go on and on and on with all those things. Very occasionally New Order, that was like a bit of gold that fell from the stars that you didn't realise was going to happen. And of course, you never knew when these records were coming out, really. You might hear one on the radio late at night as a bit of an advance warning, but you weren't really sure. So most of the time we used to go to the record shops there was two record shops in Enfield Town in North London, and after school you just go in there and they had all this kind of the crap, you know. There was all the racks of all the sort of the Dire Straits and all that kind of stuff, which was just sort of evil, even though I love Dire Straits these days. But you sort of went and looked around the racks for all the things, you know, the N for New Order, and you realised they wouldn't stock any New Order records. And then occasionally it would just be there. It would just be like, whoa, there it is. How comes I don't know this? And it would just be a beautiful sleeve. And also, of course, of New Order, you couldn't tell because they didn't have the title on the cover or the name of the artist. So you just saw this beautiful piece of art and you're like, I think this could be a New Order record. I've got a feeling it could be. You know, should we just buy it anyway? And you take it home. And so that's how I discovered music. And everything from that time was new every single week. It had just come out. And it was like a secret world. How does it feel to treat me like you do when you laid your hands on me and told me who you are? Thought I was mistaken. I thought I'd heard your words. Tell me, how do I feel? I'd heard all the pop music, Blondie and Madness and all that kind of stuff when I was at primary school, and we loved all of that, the Specials, and because they were all pop bands, you know. And around the age of 13, my brother played me the Velvet Underground and Nico. And I really remember where I was, you know, exactly. Really? In the back room where we lived in Tottenham. And I remember him putting this on, and I remember being really scared. I heard the song Venus and Furs, and I remember being quite scared because it wasn't like Atomic by Blondie or something, you know. For some reason, I started to get the feeling, maybe it was trusting in an older brother, I got the feeling that it was something to aspire to hear something that was like from a secret world.
Right.
So with the Velvet Underground, it was quite important that the Venus and Furs, then it would have Femme Fatale, which was a very beautiful, pretty song. It's very melodic. It could be any kind of a pretty folk song. Like a switch flicked in me that there was something there, an emotional trigger, when I heard music that you weren't going to see in the record shops.
Yeah. First records that you bought out of choice rather than being influenced by your brothers, you were like, I'm going to go and buy this single or this album and this is mine.
Yeah, the first one was the Smiths, the first album.
Really?
So it was my birthday. I got a record token for Christmas of 83, I guess, and I knew the Smiths album would eventually come out, and so I saved that, and then I went and got that from W.H. Smiths in Wood Green. And sort of hoped there was some kind of connection between W.H. Smiths and the Smiths, and
I never thought about that.
You know what? They'd be there or something like that, you know. And they weren't. But I remember going to get it. It came out, I think, in February or March of that year. So I saved my token, and that was it. Yeah, that's the first record I had, and I've still got.
Yeah, the romantic notion would be you heard that, you heard Johnny Marr, then you picked up a guitar. But I'm sure it wasn't quite as.
Yeah, no. I mean, it was. Just a little bit after that.
Right.
I played the violin from the age of 7 at primary school till 14, and I gave that up, and I really loved playing the violin, and I wish I still played it, but it was just very difficult. You'd get a lot of harassment at school. I went to a boys Jesuit school, and you just got spat at constantly and,
oh, no way.
And you know, called crude things, and the teachers also, you'd have to leave your lessons to go to this class, so they just harassed you about leaving lessons, and it just went on and on. I just got fed up with the whole thing. But also I was listening to all this music that had did have violins in it, and as well as guitars. Well, when the Smiths came along, yeah. It was the Smiths and Aztec Camera, I remember really clearly. Roddy Frame and Johnny Marr, seeing those two on the TV. And what happened is my brothers also saw these characters on the TV. And one of them, their mate at school was selling a guitar for £20. And what I remember about it is it had a battery amp in the back of the case as well. It was awful. And they basically bought this between them for £20 and gave it to me.
Oh.
And with a... a tune a day book.
Burt Whedon, John.
Yeah, Burt Whedon with a flexi-disc on the front. And they basically said, you learn it, teach us, and then just basically off. You know, that was it. And so I spent sort of a couple of weeks learning that. I remember about after a few weeks, they asked me to play it, and I played a few things for them, and they just sort of said, right, all right, and they just walked out. And that was it. And so it was mine after that.
It's time to tell the tale of how you took a child.
What was the first gig you went to? Or the first gig that made an impact then?
The first gig I went to was the Smiths at the Albert Hall.
Get off. What do you remember?
Well, it was my Christmas present from Christmas in 84, because it was March 85 it came out. They were playing there. And I went with my oldest brother, Stephen, and I remember the tickets were right at up at the gods. You know, the top, basically the cheapest tickets.
Yeah, it's like, almost like standing around under an arch.
That's
like,
it.
About half a mile away.
And so that was quite disappointing when I got in there, because it was the most exciting thing I'd ever done. And I got in there and I was like, wait, where's the stage? Where do the people play? James opened for them. And this is when James were sort of a vegan folk band. And they were brilliant, actually, at that time.
And in many ways, they're still a vegan folk band.
They are, yeah. And I remember, what's his name, from Dead or Alive, Pete Burns came on for the encore for Barbarism Begins at Home. And he danced around and sort of yelped a bit and stuff. And that sort of, I thought, what's that about? What's going on here? But yeah, I remember a lot about it. I remember, you know, the guitars that were used and stuff and what was played. And it wasn't a fantastic show, but it was my first gig, yeah.
So when did this increasing passion and involvement and connection with music start to coalesce into, like, well, then I'm going to get some like-minded souls with me and do this. I want to be one of the people on stage.
Well, my brothers, just as soon as they knew I could play guitar, just said, well, when are we going to start the band?
Right.
Phil, the middle one and us, he was the singer, and Stephen, the oldest, would write the words, and he'd sort of stick back and like, I'm not going to be a singer, but I'm going to write the words from the background. Right. And we were like, okay. And I got my mate Kev to play bass. He was in my class, and his brother Eugene played the drums. So it's basically because his brother had a drum kit at his house, so we used to go around there and practice songs. And that was almost straight away, you know, within a few months of starting to play.
Did you have a terrible band name?
Slowdive.
All right.
Yeah.
Ah,
Slowdive was our name. Yeah,
right.
Which it didn't turn into the shoegaze stadium band or whatever. You know, it was a Susie and the Banshees song,
right.
And we liked Susie and the Banshees. They had an album called Nocturne. It was a live album from the Albert Hall, and they played this song called Slowdive. And I don't know why we ended up with that name.
Good name though.
It's a dreadful name. Yeah, I think most good bands have dreadful names. I think that's my theory.
What about your first performance to a paying audience?
I wouldn't call it paying, but we played in the school hall in St John Vianney's Church in West Green Road, Tottenham, in 1985, May 1985. It was like sold out of just kids basically from school, yeah. And it's just a bit of a disaster, and that's all I remember. But we played Boys Don't Cry by The Cure and Harmony in My Head by The Buzzcocks.
Boys Don't Cry is a good song for a young starting band to play, because you can get that feel pretty quickly.
Yeah.
I try to
the norm is, oh, that teenager, passion for music, but at some point I have to get a proper job. And at some point you have to kind of attach your horses, normally against your parents' wishes, to the music. How did you navigate, this is what I want to do, but the reality of life means that...
Well, I mean, I didn't think that there was ever a career factor in making music. I never thought it was anything that I'd ever be successful and make a life out of. I just thought it was something I loved doing. And I didn't think at the time... See, it's not like now. I didn't know any of the artists, the people I liked. I didn't know who they were, what they did. And Manchester was a very faraway place, and Glasgow was. And you know, I'd never been to these places. I didn't think they were rich and famous. And because nobody knew... See, everyone at school liked Dire Straits and sort of Simple Minds and all that kind of... You know, all the stadium bands. So I was the only person I knew who liked the music I did, apart from my brother. So I assumed that that meant that nobody liked it, and they weren't rich or famous or anything like that. You know, they weren't living. They were just getting away with it for a while. Where I went to school and people I knew, nobody did anything. You know, nobody did anything. You went into a bank, insurance, yeah, and stuff like that, and lived nice lives, you know, teaching and all sorts of things. But, you know, no one did anything. We never met anyone famous or heard of anyone famous. You'd never seen anyone famous or anything like that, or anyone who had any kind of vaguely above the sort of breadline kind of career. Everyone we knew was builders and bus drivers and stuff.
So how did you find your tribe? How did you find your musical...
I don't think I did. I think that a tribe found me and then struggled forever to deal with me. And I think that's how it's always been. I did all right at school, you know, I hated school. I didn't care at all about it. I didn't feel like I learned anything that gave me any good stead for the future. They didn't let me do music for a start, and what? They didn't let me do art because I wasn't playing a classical instrument, so I wasn't allowed to make music. And so I hated that. But I did okay with exams and stuff, and lived a quite happy sort of secret life of just listening to music, assuming that it was only me listening to it. I went to university in London thinking I'll form a band. And I got there and everyone wanted to study.
Which is the opposite of what you go to London to form.
They just wanted to study history. I was like, what's that about? You're 18. And so I didn't get on with anybody there. And I spent my first years just spent all my money on records and walking around London because I didn't really like it. I just didn't really feel like I knew anyone had any interest. So I remember just walking around the city of London with my headphones on and listening to Technique by New Order and, you know, Happy Mondays and stuff.
What else were you listening to at that point then?
Well, by this point, the things I really loved True Blue by Madonna. I mean, it's one of my favourite ever records. And that was really important. It was Happy Happy. I was kind of loved happy stuff, you know. And I started listening to REM a little bit. But again, it's all the current music at that time. I didn't listen to anything that happened before my lifetime. Why would I? I'd never listened to the Beatles, never listened to David Bowie, anything like that. I mean, the first thing that I remember happening around that time, in that year, was I went to a party with my mate Kev, and he told me he knew some people and he didn't. He was just basically gatecrashing it. It was in Highbury, I remember. And we got there and then inevitably got thrown out really quickly. And I remember walking down the road and Kev just said, run. And so we started running and he basically nicked a load of records and they're under his coat. And he said, here, you've got to take a couple and run. And I was like, okay, great. So yeah, I'm running down the road with a couple of records under my coat. And all I remember is getting on the train and going home. And it's a bit of a crap night, you know. And when I got home, I had two albums. And one of them was Clouds by Joni Mitchell. They were both orange, weirdly. And one of them was Low by David Bowie. And I wouldn't listen to David Bowie because Let's Dance was just the cheesiest sort of nonsense at the time.
Because that's the thing that was there in front of you. Yeah,
China Girl and all that kind of stuff. I wasn't interested in any of that kind of stuff, you know. And then I heard this, and between that and Clouds by Joni Mitchell, they flicked switches for me. They were very profoundly stirring and quite dark. The start of Clouds is really dark, and obviously the B-side of Low is just really beautiful. It reminded me a lot of orchestral music that I'd left behind when I was a kid, you know. Very string-led, but obviously all on synthesizers. So they had emotional triggers, those records, and they were really important for me in my sort of journey to make sort of quite sad, miserable music. Disturbing, you know, arresting sort of music that's quite emotionally triggering. And that combined with True Blue by Madonna, that was what I was listening to at that time when I was 18, 19. It was brilliant.
I'm at BBC Radio 6 Music.
This is Indie Forever. Just non-stop indie bangers. The anthems you know and love. And a selection of our future faves. The ultimate indie lineup. Tunes that you want to blast out on those indie summer road trips. Floor fillers to get you dancing. Absolute classics guaranteed to get you in a good mood.
Indie Forever.
With me, Nathan Shepherd. Every Friday night from 9 on 6 Music. Or listen whenever you like on BBC Sounds.
Matt Everett's The First Time with Bernard Butler.
6
Music. Music. Music.
Ask you a couple of questions about Suede.
Yes.
I mean, I'm interested in that moment when a band starts to function. It goes from being a bunch of musicians, then all of a sudden they find their character. It starts to work. What was the moment for that, for Suede? Do you remember it?
Well, that was about 3 years in. I mean, it was when I met them, I answered an advert and went to meet these people, and they all lived in Notting Hill, Ladbroke Grove. And I'd never been, I'd been to Portobello for the market before, but there's no reason I'd go to West London. It was just full of yuppies, as we had called them in those days, you know. So they lived there, and I'm just like, wow, and they were pretty posh. It was something I never knew, you know, but I thought, I threw myself into it, and they were really, really funny, real characters, a bit of a gang of sort of comedians on their own when I met them, and I was really left out, but I realised straight away that I could do something they couldn't, and they were really impressed by that. So I felt on the one hand that it was kind of a patronising pat on the back, but also I was quite needed and I was quite useful. So I just, you know, embarked on that for about 6 months, just trying to fit in really around it. But again, it was that thing, you know, I didn't find my tribe, you know, another tribe brought me into the fold to be useful. That's why I always felt about it. You know, I didn't really get on, make friendships or relationships with any of the people around them or anything like that. You know, it's around Kensington and places. It was just like, this is like Disneyland for me, you know. I grew up in Haringey, So I didn't really understand any of it, but I just went along with it because it was making music and it gave me a drive and I could really drive. I didn't think they were very driven people or very good at getting things together. And I was very, my mother's son, you know, is very, we can do this and we'll do this and now we'll do this and put music together and try and get things together. Yeah. But for about 2 years, it was awful. You know, we were rubbish. We had a drum machine and not very good music at all. And, you know, tried to be a baggy band because I loved the baggy music. I loved all of that. Paris Angels and Happy Mondays and all that kind of stuff. It was great. But we were terrible at it because we were just too posh, basically. And it didn't get good until there was personal situations, not with me at all, but within the group that went really rough. And they were triggers to change. And at the same time, circumstances would change with everybody. And it was at the point where, again, I never thought that there's any career in this at all. Never thought that in any way. I think I was with people who probably thought that if you don't have a career out of it, what's the point? You had to be successful. I never had that view.
I mean, the guitar, the approach to the guitar on that first record, it's just, well, on both records.
I bought a Les Paul. I had my guitar nicked, had this lovely Epiphone Sheraton, which I'd bought when I was 16 for my first job, and it got nicked. And I didn't have a guitar for ages, so I borrowed money and then went and bought a Les Paul. And the reason I bought a Les Paul is because at the time you had all these kind of what you used to call the shoegazing bands, you know, they all had Rickenbackers and sort of millions of pedals and all that kind of stuff. And I couldn't afford any of that. And they were already really successful. And I didn't really like the music. I liked the odd song, but I just really didn't like it, the music. And it didn't do anything for me. So I got a Les Paul because they were seen as a sort of heavy rock thing to have. And I thought it was the opposite of everything.
Yeah.
And I loved the sound of it. I loved the versatility of it. It had a toggle switch here, a little switch for non-guitar players. That you switch between the pickup sounds, and it's right by your where your hand passes down as you stroke down on the guitar. So that meant that I very quickly learned how to, as I hit the guitar down, I could stroke and hit the toggle switch with my hand as it went down, and that would change the sound quite radically, exactly on the beat. And that's something I still do to this day. And it's a really simple way of being quite black and white about music.
Yeah, but that's the thing. That's the real. You can almost hear a foot being stomped on a pedal. But yeah, that real contrast between the sounds is just great. It's really effective. It places you in the room when you're listening to it as well, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I went from listening to True Blue and having a nice time dotting around London with my headphones on to everything being a little bit dark in life, you know, early 20s, I guess, yeah. And life had just, you know, taken a change of path, as it does when you start being an adult and you stop being a kid and you're living out of home and you experience different people around you and you no longer have comfort blankets and you feel like you have to fight. You start fighting to exist and with personalities and relationships. And I really felt that with music, the way I started to make music was to survive. And also with this band, it was been going on for 2 or 3 years and it was just rubbish, basically. And so going nowhere, you know, so it was just a case of like, right, literally tear up a piece of paper. What can you do to be extreme, you know? And I think, you know, we all felt that. So it evolved in a very extreme way where things were quite cut and thrust, very brutal, you know, black and white, all those kind of phrases.
Last question on the subject before we move on after Sway, but can you remember first thinking, this is done, after Dogman Star, this is it, that moment of, like, separation from Sway?
No, it was never done. You know, it was never done, that's the point, you know, it never was supposed to be, and the great myth was that I was always trying to get out and stuff like that, and that's complete rubbish. It's right. Just, it's a really, really irritating piece of narrative that's created around me, that I was always trying to get out of a band. For me, it was my band, and I wanted it, but I wanted it to be challenging and arresting and always changing and always developing. I wanted it to be the best, and when I saw this thing, going back to, I was a working class kid, and when something was in my sight, I just suddenly right now want to be the best. I don't want to just have a lovely career at this and just sit back. So I was spending, you know, 12 hours a day just working on it on my own. And that's all I wanted to do. And when I couldn't achieve that, and when I kept getting the blocks on no, hearing the word no just on everything I tried to do, I was in a fight all of the time, and basically taken out the band for that reason, because I just wanted to do things. I wanted to, and do things that quite rightly now have been seen through. You know, everybody says that record, it should have been finished, should have been mixed better, should sound better, and the producer himself says it, and that's all I wanted at the time. And I was just like, listen, it's not a very unusual thing to ask, to go and get somebody to mix your record and, you know, up your level and get it better. It's not an unusual thing to ask. And at that time, it was just like, because it was me, no, and that's where it is. So, you know, I really refute really strongly that myth that I was always trying to get out. I was always trying to make things better. I was always trying to elevate, always trying to develop it. And so when people now go on about the band and go on about that record as something that's, you know, great and all that kind of stuff, it's really at odds with the narrative that I somehow was trying to drag it back. You know, and so, no, it was never done.
There's a song playing on the radio. Sky high in the airwaves on the morning show.
What was your first production gig? Was it Edwyn Collins? Was that the first time?
No. Well, I mean, Edwyn I met just after that time, and it was an awful, awful time for me. And I met Edwyn because I obviously knew Edwyn's records, and I heard Gorgeous George, yeah, and this album, and I loved it. And at that time, no one was buying it, no one was playing Edwyn, no one cared. He was a has-been, you know, washed up. So I knew through friends somebody knew Edwyn, and I ended up meeting Edwyn, and we started hanging out, and Edwyn was living in this little flat in Kensal Rise, and he'd made that record in Wood Green above a post office, and he'd set up all the gear. He'd made the record in like a couple of months and then packed it all down because he couldn't afford the rent. And so he had all this gear in his flat, and so he'd come over to my flat and he'd bring me stuff like a microphone or a compressor or things like this, bits of technical gear, and I didn't know what they were, because at the time I wanted to know what they were, but I didn't know. So Edwyn would come around with a bottle of wine and say, ah, you don't need to know how to use it, just plug it in. just turn it up, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we had a lot of fun. He was really, really important to me, really inspiring at that time, because his whole ethic was punk and he hated the idea of big recording studios and the music industry, and loved the idea of somebody who was looking at it in a naive way. And I did, and learned from him, and he was a really brilliant character to learn from. And so I was really lucky at that time. And then he kept going off for weekends and going off to Belgium for a couple of days, and then he'd go to Belgium for a week, and I'd say, why are you going to Belgium? And he said, oh yeah, they're playing the song there. And I said, and then he'd come back after a couple of months and he'd be like, you know, it's number one in Belgium for like 3 months. And it was about a girl like you. And he'd be going there and be treated like a king. And he'd come back and he'd just be Edwin again, you know. And this went on for about a year. And eventually the song broke everywhere, you know. Very inspiring character to me. He taught me how to do things, and he taught me that you didn't need a big studio. Plug in a microphone, make some noise, record it, and if you say it's a record, it's a record. That's what he taught me, and everything I'd learned before that was, don't touch that, mate. Stay away from there, mate. Don't even look at that. Stay back. Sit in your cage, you know, do in there. Don't go near anything. So it was really refreshing.
Yeah, and you've got some great songs in one's arsenal. And one's catalogue and the people that you work with. And you've got Yes. You've got McCammon and Butler. You've got Yes. You've got that song, which is still... You know, you talk about some songs that age and don't age. That song is aging gloriously. It still sounds great, that record. Mm. People still connect to it.
It was fabulous. You know, it was just brilliant. It was just like opening a bottle of champagne that came everywhere for 2 days. I went to Mike Hedge's studio. Mike had worked with The Cure and The Beautiful South. Amazing records Mike has. And he had his chateau in Normandy. Nice. With this desk that he'd got from EMI in the 80s, and they were chucking out, and he needed salvaged. And it was in his front room, no soundproofing, nothing. It was just a front room, a ballroom, chandeliers, old furniture, his EMI desk. And me and David went over there. I bought these two boiler suits, blue boiler suits like mechanics wear, you know, and I said to David, we're going to wear these for the whole session for 3 days.
We're going to work.
And, yeah, we're going to work. It was that ethic. Yeah, we're going to go to work and we're going to do it for 3 days and then we're going to go home. And it was just before Christmas, so remember that.
3 days?
And, yeah, it was like 3 days. And we went over there to Mike's, did that. It was amazing feeling. I went with my drummer, Mako, who's no longer with us. And Mako didn't speak any English. And Mike had a wine cellar, like a stone wine cellar in the chateau. And that was the drum room. So that was the sound of those drums on that record, you know. I remember Mako going in there and just splashing about and just making this racket just to practice. And I remember going down there and I was like, man, this is it. Let's just do this. That's what it's going to be, you know, the sound of this wine cellar, full on distorted. And so we made it in a real sort of rush of energy and noise. And Mike, again, was another one of those characters who Mike liked to sit in the back of the room on the sofa, and he'd say, if you want to know how to do something, go over to that desk and do it. I'd ask him, how, you know, can I do this? And he said, yeah, go and twist the knob and twist it as far as it goes until you hear it distort, and then see what happens. Again, a really good character for me to try things, to see what can happen. So it was a good few days, you know, and we came home just before Christmas with this tape and just thought, what was that all about, you know? So you wanna know me now, how I've been. You can help someone recover after what you did. So tell me, am I looking better? Will you my favourite ever record. I've made, because the whole principle was we were going to have this one song. There was two songs, Yes and You Do, and they both had the same chord shape, but they would had two different tempos. One was incredibly euphoric and the other was incredibly emotional. So the principle was the same shapes would create these two moods of music. It would be a 7-inch in a disco bag, used to call them, with a hole, with nothing on it. No T-shirts, no tour, no nothing. Just like, give it away. Because of where I was coming out of Suede, I was just so completely fed up with everything to do with corporate music industry. I just wanted to make a piece of music and that'd be the last one. Basically, that'd be it. I'd do this and that's the end of it. I wanted nothing out of it. We didn't do a tour, didn't do anything. And it was a brilliant victory because, you know, radio didn't play it. The magazines wouldn't feature us, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it got into the charts. It was top 10 first week and we got on Top of the Pops. And that was like, wow, everyone then just pricked up their ears and said, what's going on here?
Yeah. Tell me a bit about witnessing the Duffy phenomenon, because in doing my research for this, I was looking back and I was going, the scale of that record and the scale of her success and the attention that she got, that was one of those kind of... It doesn't happen very often when someone becomes so big so quickly and a record, people just connect with it straight away and it happens. What was it like being part of that and then witnessing that?
It's really exciting, you know. Yeah. I met her on this like Friday afternoon, and I was managed by Rough Trade at the time, and they said to me, "You know, we've got this girl, and don't know what to do, and it's all just not really happening." And she's got this great voice, and I was just like, "Look, I'll give it a try, whatever," you know. And I remember hearing something, and it was all very how can I describe it? Her voice worked on one range, and that's all. She just sang this one range. It was quite polite, but I could hear it was quite big, it was quite rich, and quite a big voice. As always, you know, I always think of what have you got, and then you look at what could something be, you know, whatever something is, then it's not being all these other things. So here's my analogy I always look at. If you go into a pub or, you know, a club or something like that, and you look at one end of it and everyone's there having a great time, you know, you see 10 people having a great time laughing and stuff, you look around the room and you see one person at the other end doing the crossword, who's more interesting? To me, I always look like, why are you there? You're interesting me, rather than all the successful, beautiful people at the other end. So I always look at that. And I always make that analogy about music. If you can find that place, the person who's in the corner, they're intriguing. With Duffy, I met her on a Friday afternoon. She didn't know who I was and wasn't very interested, to be honest. You know, she didn't care one way or the other. And I met her at Mako. Again, Mako's studio had this little studio. All I had was a drum kit and a computer. And I had this piece of music that was just a piano riff, basically, and there was no chorus to it. It was three sections, and it was like a blues. And I had this principle that I was going to make a piece of music that got bigger and bigger without ever having a chorus. And at each stage, something else happened and changed, and the register got bigger, you know, like a journey, like the whole thing. So she came down, and she'd been on the train for like 8 hours from Wales to get there. I love trains in songs, and so I always look at it as journeys. So we started talking about the train journey and the stops and how she'd got there and how exhausted she was. So we started writing about train journey, and the train journey had gone through a place called Rock Ferry, which is where her nan used to live on the way. So it was just about that, and we wrote these words for the first verse, just about a journey. Then we recorded it, one take, that was it, just the first verse, and then said, well, what should we do for the second verse? And I said, well, we'll write something else, but we'll sing it like a fifth up or something, you know, just a little bit up. And so she went for that, we wrote some more words, we recorded the second verse. I said, right, the final verse, we're going to go the octave of where we started, which is, so it's 8 notes up. And she said, no, I'm not doing that. And I said, well, we're doing it. She said, no, I don't want to be like Mariah Carey, or, you know, you don't want to do that sort of big operatic voice. And I said, well, exactly why you've told me you don't want to do it is exactly why I'm going to force you to do it. And so I forced her to do it. She sang it one take and recorded it. And so we had these three separate one take vocals. And then she said, right, I'm out of here. And so she went home and I took it home. But I just put some guitar in it and put it through my space echo to all this reverb. And I played it to Rough Trade on the Monday. And I just said, look, this is either really awful or really quite good, one or the other. You either get it or you don't. It's one of those songs, you know. And so, yeah, they loved it. And then from there, she went back and she did lots of other sessions. And then she got all the big hits. None of mine were the hits, you know, but that's not surprising to me, you know. But mine was the title track. I love her. She's great. She's interesting. She's a working class kid. Mm. You know, she's got a massive story behind her. She went from naught to a million in that period of time. And then everyone says, what's your problem? And I was just like, you try doing that to any human being. That's, you know, point. And trying to stay sane and making your life normal, it's not. It's really not. And I talk to her all the time. And we write songs all the time on the side. And we'll do something again.
Would have been a year ago that we spoke about, well, I spoke to you and Jesse,
yeah,
about that record and how, I mean, I don't know if easy is ever the right word, but it sounded like a really relaxed record to make.
Jesse got in touch at a time when I'd done all this kind of pop songwriting,
yeah,
with sort of gorgeous 18-year-olds, you know, who wanted to be famous, I'd meet them and they'd say, what, I'd do the same as Duffy, I'd say, what have you been up to, try and find the song. And increasingly I'd find, they'd say, I've just come back from Aspen with my girlfriend, you know, I'm going to Hawaii after Christmas. I'm like, really? Really? You expect me to write songs about skiing? Do you know what I mean? Skiing and surfing, you know, it's like, you don't need to write songs. You need to get in a bank or something, you know, and get into Wall Street. And so I've got really fed up with these beautiful people who are just like so uninteresting as young people. And I got asked about Jessie and I was sort of intrigued, really. And I saw this thing on the TV she'd done and I don't know what it was about. I was intrigued. And the Irish obviously intrigued me. And I spoke to her and, you know, it turned out she's from Kerry and I didn't know that. I'd spent a lot of time as a kid in Kerry and I knew exactly where she was from and that was quite a connection. She was stuck in London basically because Fargo was cancelled. I think it was Fargo she was doing or something like that was cancelled because of COVID. So I was kind of like all that was left, you know. And we wrote a song.
Well, I'm going to end up with Bernard then,
yeah,
nothing
exactly
else to do.
It was that. And I thought, yeah, fair enough. So we wrote a song. It wasn't very good. And I thought, that's not going to happen again. And then she texted me and said, can I come over on Tuesday? And I said, yeah, come over, do what you want, you know. And so we did write a song. And after about 3 weeks, this kept happening. Every time the process was, we'd sit in my kitchen with no recording equipment at all. And I just had this acoustic guitar. And I tuned it to Dadgad, which is like the folky old tuning,
yeah,
which I'd never used before. And I thought, she doesn't know what she's doing, so I'll make it so I don't either,
right,
you know, and make it so we're both out on a limb. I thought it'd be interesting. And what we did is we taught for hours. The two of us just taught for like 3 hours. And we'd get books off the shelf and we'd open the books randomly, you know, and say, what is this? I don't know who this person is or what they're talking about. What is this? And we talk about a paragraph in a book, and then we'd do it again with another book. And so we'd start lifting stories from books we'd never read, and we started assembling, and I'd be writing these things down. And then in the last half hour or so, we'd do a song, and she'd sing it, we'd record it on our phones, and she went. That happened all through that summer, and we had 13 songs. And then she said, right, I'm off. And she went off to do, I don't know, a film or something like that. And that was it. And I didn't hear from her for months. And then she came back and I said, you know, we can do a record. And she said, no. And I said, well, that's what we do.
We've done you know. The first bit.
And she's like, no, I just wanted to do the creative bit. You know, she just loved creating things. And so I kind of forced her to do some recording. What I did is I recorded the music myself along to these phone tracks.
Right.
So acoustic guitars and pianos and percussion and drums and all this sort of stuff over the top until you could only barely hear Jessie's voice now. And then I sent it to her and triggered something because she thought that was an interesting process. So she then said, right, okay, that's good. You know, can we release that? And I was like, no, we've got to sing on it. So she sang on it and it went like that. And then we finished the record and she didn't want to release it. And then we released it. And then so we'd do some shows and she didn't want to do the shows really. It was a trip. I got as far as I could with it all, you know. And then Jessie went back to acting or whatever she's doing this week, which could be anything really. So it was amazing. I mean, what frustrated me about it is she played every card that I played on other people. Is the first person who played them all on me to really challenge things and really try and turn things around and do things completely differently. But I love her and I love the music we made and that stuff. So it was very pure. It's an incredibly pure process and experience. And it sounds like it to me.
Final thing. Can you pick the last track? What should we go out on?
Final song, just of anything.
Of anything you want.
I would be When Will I See You Again by the 3 Degrees.
Why that song?
Do you know why? Because very interesting you say why, because every single line is a question and I love that about it. No one ever notices about that song. And it's a beautiful piece of music.
And that's the song we'll finish on. It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was the 3 Degrees with When Will I See You Again, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time Today, Bernard Butler. And Bernard is right. Every single line of that song is a question. Never noticed that. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Corinne Bailey-Ray. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from the archive, including my conversations with Janelle Monáe, Tom York, Chris Connell, and Liam Gallagher. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.